Straight Jack, episode 8. We review 3 films every week, 1 new release, 1 post-2000 release, and 1 pre-2000 release. And we have a theme this week of manipulative women.
Ooh.
Is that what it is?
Aren't they all? There go the feminists.
At least we might get our first email.
Alienated half of the viewership. But
this week's new release was chosen by Ian.
Which was the new Whit Stillman film called Love and Friendship, which is a Jane Austen. It's a period drama, but it is technically a rom-com, but not in the sort of conventional sense. There is a lot of romance and a lot of laughs. And it's set in the 1790s and features a widowed Kate Beckinsale, who, as I think is a familiar theme in a lot of the Jane Austen novels, it's all about how these women who, as a result of the times, have to rely on men. And we see quite an interesting take here with Kate Beckinsale sort of having to use her manipulative streak and her sort of her scathing words almost to kind of try to get to where she thinks she deserves to be. So she moves in with her, she's widowed, so she moves in with her in-laws. And before too long, her daughter runs away from boarding school to join, followed on by a character who is supposed to be courting her and is trying to wed her. As they both seek a husband, laughs ensue. Discuss.
And laughs do ensue.
They do.
I genuinely sat in the theatre last night with an old lady sat next to me, and we were both laughing out loud at this film, which, I mean, I'm obviously not his target audience. Absolutely.
We're not, are we, at all?
I wouldn't have thought so.
No.
But it was a completely eye-opening experience for me. I thoroughly enjoyed the film. I was laughing non-stop. I was very interested to see where everyone's character arcs went. I was so surprised at how much I enjoyed it.
Could you just see, I think you just see on the poster or just like a glimmer of a trailer, and you see that, you see the corset and you go, no, that's not, that's one I'll tell my mum, see if she, make sure she goes, yes, to check that one out. But of course I'll never see that. But having seen the last few, I haven't seen his first two, but seeing the last 3 Whit Stillmans, I sort of knew to expect something's quite familiar theme. Pretty much I think all of his films are about the bourgeois. They're always about wealthy people and how they have struggles too, and it might not be the most relatable struggles, but they have struggles. And they're very often hilarious struggles. Mm. And he certainly, it's a different time to his typical stuff, but he definitely carries that theme on through here.
Apologies to put a bit of a dampener on things.
Oh, no.
I'm not quite sure where all the positivity around this film is coming from. This film didn't really, for someone who doesn't particularly engage in period dramas, for someone who has never heard of Whit Stillman, for someone who loves Kate Beckinsale from a aesthetics point of view, but from an acting point of view is, you know, subpar. I was annoyed by how little I got from this film. Now, Kate Beckinsale is really good.
She is. She is the best thing about
it. Yeah, and that's what almost, it's not frustrates me, but this reminds me of how good she can be. And then it makes it all the more frustrating when you think about what her back catalogue in the last 5 to 10 years, I'd probably say, has been.
I can't think of anything that she's been in the last...
There's Click, there's The Underworlds.
Oh, wow.
There's a string of poor choice after poor choice.
Hardly testing herself.
No, exactly. And for me, this film, it didn't do much for me, but it did remind me how good Kate Beckinsale can be. Mm. And the slight caveat to that is that having watched her on lots of interviews doing the press tour, doing the marketing for this film, you realise that she's pretty much playing herself. She's got that bit of sass. She's very quick-witted, very smart. And that's exactly what her character is, albeit she has much more political aims in this film, where she is very manipulative and she's able to, just through her words and through her manoeuvring, she is able to pretty much get anyone to do what she wants them to do. There are some laughs, limited for me. I can't think I laughed that many times. You know when someone else in the cinema is laughing hysterically,
yeah,
and it makes you even more aware of how unfunny you're finding. Yeah. And that's the issue I had. I had this woman to the left of me who was cracking up, and I didn't
even
get
before
that
the jokes.
No, yeah. I think for me, Tom Bennett he did tickle me. I think he was probably the funniest part for me. He sort of has that Brent nature to him.
I've got him underlined, I think. Yeah. I was not really familiar with him, But he just soon
TV adverts.
I'm pretty
TV adverts. That's the only way I've seen him. I haven't seen him in anything else other than in random TV adverts.
I certainly hope he crops up again, yeah. Because he, as soon as he pops on screen, he is just this breath of fresh. You've got no idea what to. Is he going to carry this on? Yes, and he will for the entire remaining hour and a quarter. And just just talking about peas.
Those peas.
These what do you call them? Like comical. It says something like comical vegetable. Just like as though they're just put them on the plate for a laugh. But
it did miss him, I think, for me. And maybe
when he wasn't on screen.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think when I last saw him on screen. I think it's probably about half an hour towards the end, if I remember correctly. You just didn't see him. He was so good that it made me really lament when he wasn't in there. Kate Beckinsale did.
Did Kate not then step into the forefront and then steal it again? Was that not? But was it just not enough?
She did. But it's a little bit like when I watch or read, you know, Shakespearean text or Shakespearean films or plays, whatever it is, and they're speaking in the Shakespearean language, and it's like the zingers don't quite hit and the punchlines don't quite hit for me because they're hidden in this really quite enigmatic language that I can't quite break down.
It was really interesting how it took me like an extra like 2 or 3 seconds to process the words, and then I was sort of having like belated laughter, and I sort of really enjoyed that. I think it was a different experience for me, not just to have Seth Rogen does a funny ha ha ha.
I completely agree, and would say that maybe that's why I like the film a bit more, because I don't usually understand or I can't keep up with it.
Yeah,
I couldn't do that because she laughed immediately, to the point where then I felt self-conscious, like what's she laughing at, to the point where I've completely lost what's going on the screen. I'm trying to think
what was it
she was laughing at, and then I'm thinking it through and then I'm missing everything because it's quite quick-witted. I mean, it's a bit sort of Sorkin in that way where there is quite quick back and forth, and I think this film just completely bypassed me. I fear when we come to the end and we mark it, I may well be doing it a disservice, but yeah, it didn't quite work for me.
We haven't mentioned, Chloe Sevigny.
Probably for the best.
Chevonier at all. She really does sort of fall into the background and doesn't really, she's a big name in independent film. So, and she's been in at least two of Witt's previous films, but she doesn't get anywhere near a meaty enough role here, and she isn't really a part of it, which that was a bit of a disappointment when you have Stephen Fry in it for like a scene.
Stephen Fry takes me out of every film, because whenever I see him I think, right, this is a film now.
Yeah, it's just a name and it just sort of pops up, and it doesn't feel, there's something very inorganic, very much in The Hobbit as well. I just felt very inorganic sort of just slotting him in. And the other interesting stylistic flourish was the way each character was introduced as well.
Mm-hmm. Really liked it, the title cards.
Title cards, but also not just... So there were one or two that just said, so-and-so is related to this person. Mm. But then it also said, had like some of them, because there were so many in a row when you were first meeting everyone, there were some witty remarks, and thought that was quite an amusing way of truly understand what's going on here. You have to know off the bat who all the key players are to see. So then you go, right, here's the family tree, these people could potentially be involved with these, and then Kate Beckinsale comes in like a whirlwind and just tangles them all together. This is a
damning indictment of my attention span, because I agree the title cards were really well done and a nice touch, but immediately forgot who they were referring to. They briefly showed who the individual was and what their name was. They would refer to them afterwards. I could not remember who on earth they were talking about.
But
which for me,
true.
I'm not sure whether that's my fault or the film should do more to make sure that I remember.
I agree. I think the title cards were a nice flourish, but I did find, because there were so many, you were bombarded straight off the bat. As a result, it did find it a little bit difficult. It was only the key names that you remembered as they kept sort of cropping up.
Yeah.
This film needed it so that it could fit into 90 minutes.
Yeah.
So you're not trying to work out
who
it is.
And stuff, yeah.
You are just kind of gone, these are the people, this is how they're related, done.
Yeah. Yeah, fair play, fair comment. Two stars straight in. I think I've covered everything, all the ground I needed to. I clearly don't like it or didn't appreciate it as much as you guys did. Again, there were some mitigating circumstances around that perhaps, but yeah, 2 stars for me.
Fair. I think what is quite interesting is we do all definitely rate in a different way, but I would just have to give it just a 4, because I think the amount I did laugh and the amount there was enough, and maybe it's out of my own ignorance and having not seen enough sort of comedic period drama films, but I found it way funnier than I thought I would. And the way that it made me laugh with the sort of delayed reaction was it did introduce something refreshing. And I did think, yeah, for the pretty much the bulk of it, the cast was pretty impeccable. And yeah, it was just a nicely woven story, so I have to give it a light four.
Nice. Yeah, comfortable and surprising 3 stars from me. I agree with your sentiments, Ian, but it just, I don't think I enjoyed it enough to give it a 4.
Yeah, I think it just creeps over the line for me.
Mm. I think maybe if I watched more period dramas, would it lessen it or would it make it better? I don't know, maybe I'd realise how good it was, or maybe I'd realise it's not as good as the others.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Nice spread, 2, 3, 4.
And on to the post 2000 film.
Which was David Fincher's Gone Girl, which I think is our first true adaptation of a book that had incredible hysteria around it, really. I think this seems to be the modern day now, where a fantastic book comes out and immediately the film rights are bought, and a film comes out in the next couple of years. Girl on a Train is a classic example it's going to be coming up. Before I go into talking about the film, I think you Robbie, sort of told me about the book. And I think both, we absolutely love the book. And then I think when we both finished the book, there was very much a case of the film's coming out, David Fincher is the perfect person to capture what Gone Girl is all about. And I think you and I are both, you know, fans of Fincher already, but this seemed like a match made in heaven. And the book, and then obviously the adaptation, this adaptation revolves around primarily Nick Dunn, who's this very average, albeit wealthy guy on the 5-year wedding anniversary between him and his wife. She goes missing, hence the title. She goes missing, and there is from there, really, I don't really care to say too much more on that. From there is a developing story of intrigue, of escalation, of suspicion, of mystery, and to hit it straight off the bat, when we think about what this theme is around manipulative leading ladies, there very early on there is a suspicion, and there is an implication that Nick doesn't quite believe that his lovely Amy, his amazing Amy, was indeed captured herself, and maybe has been framing him all along.
I mean, he never takes it seriously, does he? He's smiling from the off. I mean, he
and to his own downfall, because both the media, the police, they immediately suspect. They don't paint him as a villain. They don't quite go that far, but they just drop little hints in there of his apathy and just his complete disregard for what a relationship should be. You know, I say in inverted commas.
And that is perfect. I mean, I think when we saw the trailer, I think discussed it definitely with you, Robbie. Initially, it was Ben Affleck as, you know, who's going to be Batman? Ben Affleck, for goodness sake, not again. He's a terrible actor. As it turns out, his cardboard, ludicrous face, I think, was actually kind of perfect for this. He is this sort of jock who's probably always had it too good and didn't quite know, when he actually was under like real scrutiny from the media, how should he behave, how should he look. And I think in retrospect it's genius casting, as well as obviously Rosamund Pike.
Well, I think the casting
was a relevant unknown at the time, and the casting is sensational all the way through.
Neil Patrick Harris I think was one of the big ones. Ben Affleck was certainly the one that everyone picked up on, but then Neil Patrick Harris, because he was big at that time, and now less so, but How I Met Your Mother was really on it. I think he was hosting the Oscars as well. So
that's right. Was up for Oscars. Yeah.
So I think he was big news. But also, there aren't really any stars in this film. When you think about what a massive film it is, a famous adaptation with David Fincher, you know, big guns like that.
It's just Ben. Because Rosamund, I think it was, well, it's the film that made, certainly, shot her to stardom. Right down to the, you know, your Emily Ratajkowskis and your Lola Kirks as well, and in a very small role.
Tyler Perry.
Standout. Very good. Kim Dickens as well, who plays the same character in every single, but she's fantastic. I love her as Detective Boney.
Fantastic.
Who, her and her partner, less so her partner, but as a collective, their partnership when they're with Nick, when they're interacting, when they're going through the whole detection process, just so grounded, and just makes it feel so authentic and real about, they're just humans doing a job that everyone else is doing. Mm. Did you read the book before you seen the film?
I had not. I had absolutely no idea.
Fantastic.
What to come. And Perfect. without going into any detail, without giving anything, because that would truly be that. I think I feel so privileged the fact that I can't read. The twists and turns really do your empathy, and you're like, oh, and I, all good crime stories, especially murder cases, should do. Who done it? It really does keep you guessing, and the way, there's something about the way Fincher manipulates you as a viewer here. You're being thrown around, and by, you get towards the end, you just don't know what to think anymore. But I think, yeah, this is the master of a genre of the contemporary English speaking crime film since Seven. I think he's been the best at this for quite a few years now, and he's just someone, I don't think this is his absolute best, but it's not far off. He's operating at the absolute sort of height of his powers. He's got, I think, his cinematographer, I think it's Jeff Cronenweth,
yeah.
Who has done the last sort of three films, and it's this Atticus Ross and
Trent Reznor
again, just gets it perfect, and it just looks, there are just bits of shadow and just cracks, and it's the thing that I know that I didn't realise until rewatching it. It's kind of Southern Gothic is this kind of True Detective series one is the perfect sort of modern example. This is kind of the wealthy sort of Southern Gothic, because it's set in is it Missouri?
Yeah.
And you have no idea, but there's still this sort of looming, and there is still sort of the way the community is sort of set out, and the reason why these who have done well for themselves, these almost quite arrogant, like wealthy characters, have come down to schlock it in this small town, and yet they still feel like they're above everyone. And I think it, again, Fincher creates another three-dimensional world that you just want to look around, you just want to go there and just drive up and down the cul-de-sacs and just you just want to explore and go to all these locations. I think it's another just fantastic world he's created.
I was watching it on my phone and felt awful for doing so. I mean, this was the second time of watching it, but I was missing out on so much, and you don't know what you've got till it's gone.
Yeah.
As soon as you're watching it on this tiny screen, you're just like, the atmosphere I'm missing out on. I'm not feeling the same way about it as I did the first.
Atmosphere is a good word with this film particularly, but with all Fincher. You know, he creates, it's just dripping with Fincher. It's dripping with style and darkness and just something. And again, we'll come on to sort of the book to the film adaptation, but I think regardless of using this as a standalone film, it just, there's so much intrigue in here that you just never know what is going on. And that's the one thing that fell down for me. And it's got nothing to do with the fact of the way the film was done or Fincher or the acting. It's the fact that it's an adaptation in the first place. And I feel terrible for saying this because I hate those people who say, oh, it's not as good as the book. It's not as good as the book. But with something like this, with as many twists and turns as it has, I couldn't divorce myself away from prior knowledge. I knew what was going to happen. Yes, stylistically, it looked different to perhaps how I would have imagined it when I read the book. But I know what happens.
It was quite interesting for me because I remember, although I really enjoyed the film the first time round, I read the book within the first year, like within that year.
Yeah.
So it was very fresh. I knew every single little detail and was criticising it at every point. I still loved it, but it was very easy to see where I felt he slipped up. Second time of watching it, I'd forgotten all the smaller points, although okay, I remember the big ones. So it did feel like I was sort of watching it for the first time to an extent. And then it made me realise what a really great, great film it is.
He's a genius.
It's really good. And it is gripping. He does it. He's done it again.
For 2.5 hours. I mean, I watched it the first time not knowing how long it was, and I had no idea. I looked it up yesterday and I was absolutely horror struck. I could not believe it. And then, okay, put it on again. I know what's coming. Straight away, it's been, I think, a couple of years since it was released at the cinemas here. And again, just you're straight in the world and it just flies by. And that's the sign of any film that is of a substantial length. If you clearly are checking your watch and you're sort of noting how long something is, they have overstretched it or it's a bit bloated. Not here. And I think all of his recent films have been quite long.
Similar length, you know, towards somewhere between 2 and 2.5 hours.
The director's cut, I think, is even verging on 3.
Yeah.
I mean, that was where the downfall came, the Zodiac, where you've got a detective. I mean, I forget her name. She's a good detective in this, but you compare her to Mark Ruffalo. I mean, there's only one winner. And I don't know. Okay. I think the Zodiac in particular has a certain just a certain sort of more us, like, even more ruthless than this. I mean, there is a scene that we really can't discuss. It's just fantastically well done. But aside from that, it was lacking an edge. The dread is there, but it's not. There was no sort of pinprickle on the back of your neck and your arm kind of moments here, as there were a dozen in the Zodiac for me. It was lacking a certain quality to make it his, to stand it up against his absolute best. For me personally, I know that that's obviously a very personal choice.
A couple of negatives, and I don't know whether this is just me being really pedantic, but the first 10 minutes are excruciatingly bad. Like, awful.
It feels very wooden, doesn't it?
The dialogue is disgustingly bad. It's like so cringeworthy and cliche. And now I'm going to be really technical, and I hate talking like this, but the ADR is the most obvious ADR. They're in a lift or this elevator thing. It's almost like you could have a black screen and you can hear their voices come in. It's terrible. It's so poorly done.
I totally agree. I couldn't. The first time I watched it, and I remember Robbie, who works in ADR, brought it up, and I went, "No, it was fine, wasn't it?" And I rewatched it, and I didn't even have Robbie's comment in the back of my mind. I was exactly the same. I was like, "Oh, it is noticeable, isn't it?" But how have they just accidentally put that reel in, like, yeah, the first reel without the edits? But it's still. I mean, I almost quite like it, because at that, again, without trying to give anything away, at that point, are we perhaps seeing things through a certain perspective?
And this is my only,
that may make them seem a little bit more fairy tale,
is,
and
it supposed,
as a result,
to be, yeah,
it's a bit more schlocky than the rest of the film,
yeah,
because it's being seen through someone's gaze, but maybe we don't know it yet.
I can only assume that, and that's exactly my thought as well. That's my only justification for why it'd be like that. And I can't imagine Fincher would have knowingly let that get through the cut. How bad that was, and I can only rely on the fact that he would have known how bad that was. But then there were, in that same 10 minutes as well, it's almost like he was trying to learn the adaptation, because there are a couple of moments which I think are pretty much line for line, verbatim from the book, which don't quite work. Almost the very first things is, am I a warlord, B, whatever, and C, this. And this conversation, this sort of flirtation that they have doesn't work, but word for word it's in the book. And you almost thought, is this him trying to get to grips with the book and you know, translating it into a film, and it didn't quite work? Or, as you said there, Ian, is it this making it far more of a fairy tale than perhaps than it should be, or perhaps that it was, and we're just trying to see it through those glasses?
And then we snap out of it.
Yeah.
As the story unfolds, we snap out. I mean, we'd be coming up with these sort of things to justify it to ourselves as to why it was done that way, because it does stick out. But no, aside from that, and as well, I would say when it gets that final image is quite something to behold. It really does leave it does still somehow leave you with such afterthought. Not saying it leaves it open, but it leaves you with such afterthought that it's reminiscent of so many things. And again, trying not to give it away, but there was a sort of a Side Effects meets Rosemary's Baby kind of feeling towards the end. And if you go and watch it, obviously, with someone else, there is something to discuss over a drink afterwards, for sure.
It's a good point, actually. It's bound to get people talking. The book did. And I think maybe I, with the hysteria around the book and adapting it to a film, maybe I just lost out on what people were talking about in the film, because it is a real conversation starter, isn't it? I mean, there is a lot in this film put it this way, there are a lot of moments in this film where there are genuine gasps from that people just cannot believe what they're seeing on the screen, which, again, I come back to, and this is, you know, my issue with it, is that I knew that those gasps were coming, and I think that's the frustration that I have. I think the cast, however bizarre it is very good. You said the word wooden earlier. For anyone watching, even if you're watching the first 10 seconds, you'll never see more wooden acting than Ben Affleck putting his bins out, and then he just sort of stands there and huffs. Honestly, go back tonight and watch the first 10 seconds and you'll see what I mean, because it's just such, it's so obvious acting, which in itself is, that very essence is the suggestion of terrible acting, when you can tell that they are acting. But for me, it does capture the book well. It's got great atmosphere, great intrigue, great escalation, twists and turns, style. It's daring, and it goes for down avenues in it, and it shows things that perhaps other films wouldn't, and for me it deserves to be commended, and I'd give it 4 stars.
Yeah, 4 for me as well. I know we shouldn't go on about it, the reading the book first and how I do think it was a good book adaptation, and it's not things that he left out which I felt went a bit wrong. It's things that he included, and sorry, Fincher included, and perhaps just didn't do it the way that I really, really pictured it in my head, and the way that most people would picture it in their heads. But also then you've got the wooden acting and the massive lack of chemistry between Ben Affleck and Rosamund Pike in the opening 10 minutes does knock it down a bit. But yeah, hey, it's very, very, very good.
I would, yeah, fours across the board. It was actually, I was debating giving it a five because it was so strong, but it will get compared against his other works, which are in the same genre, and he's proven that within the last sort of 10 years, he's capable of going that little bit further and creating some of the very best films of a decade, and I don't think this is quite that, but fantastic four-star film.
Which takes us on to Body Heat.
The film we were all waiting for. The maverick of the group, the like classic. School Ties a couple of weeks ago.
The mystery. The wild card.
Before I go on describing the plotline, it's very, very important that I get this out of the way. There are three main characters, all with very confusing names. You've got the main character, Ned, played by William Hurt, who starts up an affair with a notorious businessman's wife called Matty.
Is it Matty?
Matty, I believe.
It's Matty, isn't it?
It's spelt Matty, but it's pronounced Maddie.
Oh, God. That is confusing.
And the notorious businessman is called Ed. So you've got yeah. Ned, Ed and Matty.
Ridiculous. In hindsight.
And this is from the writer of Raiders of the Lost Ark and Star Wars Episode 4. So...
So Ned and Matty start up an affair. Ned wants to be exclusive, but Matty sort of feels the same way, but also wants to divorce her husband with taking all of his money. Unfortunately can't because she signed a prenup. So they come up with a little plan together to off the husband, Ed. And the film continues with this murder plot and sex scandal.
Sex scandal.
We're not the Daily Mail.
Starting off proceedings, I think the first half an hour is really, really hammy. There's this underlying sax score. There is this really, really painful dialogue where it's all about like...
It was probably about the heat, because I don't know if you know, but it's quite warm at the time.
It was really warm.
It was really warm, and everyone says it in every scene at the start, and everyone, William Hurt has sweat patches in every scene. I think that is a record. But that's okay. Like Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, the heat, you know, it all builds, and that's why, and there is actually a great piece of dialogue early on. So, you know, people go, we could start killing people if it gets this hot.
Yeah, but that's what else. It was just like...
And the sax score's got to be defended. Bearing in mind, this did come out in 1981. So the sax score is... At the time, it's like listening, you know, to Lady Gaga now, I suppose. You know.
But for them to look at each other and just be so teasing and so obvious about it and then kind of go, oh, it's enough to kill a man. It's just...
Ted Danson knows how to act. What can we say? Who knew that a young Ted Danson looked so great?
Best thing about this film, Ted Danson, some of his dialogue, some of his line, you talk about some of the hammy dialogue. Ted Danson, every single scene he's in, he's saying something hilarious. And he's just got such... He's so charismatic. I've only ever seen him in Curb playing same. Ted Danson. So I hadn't actually realised he was... other than Cheers, Ooh. Is that what made it, where he made himself famous? Yes. I've only ever seen him in Curb, so it was refreshing to see him playing a genuine role and coming up with some absolute zingers. He was great.
His scene where he has a sort of an interrogation with the main character, Ned, is really clever. That was the turning point for me. That was when I realised, hang on, we are dealing with a very, very well-written film here. That's when the mind games for me really, really began and stopped being really cliché.
You actually do start to then question people's motives and you do start to think about it a lot more than the simple A and B want to get rid of C, they're going about it this way, and it just sort of, it does by sort of, I think it's about maybe midway through, after like an hour, things heat up, and for the sort of remaining sort of 50 odd minutes, it does, there is enough here, and I think that's what makes it stand out. I think it's refreshing enough compared to like a lot of the other sort of neo-noirs of the time, erotic or not. It follows much of the same rules here, but I just think, yeah, it's just done well. It's just done competently. It's not trying to reinvent the wheel, but it just does. It just looks great, and it's ticked off all the boxes. And I think it's just competent. Would you guys think it's as good or as bad as the films of the time?
I would say it's better than competent.
Yeah,
I thought it was very, very well made.
Yeah,
I mean, I did stifle laughter through the first half an hour, but that by the end it was completely irrelevant when I realised how stupid I was being.
Don't we all about pastel shirts as well from the 80s and everything else? But
I don't think it developed in the it took the first half an hour for the plot to actually become clear about what this film was trying to do.
Okay.
The first half an hour was character development, is probably being generous. It was just more a case of almost more sort of context development, sort of environment development. We talk about how hot it was and just getting a real feel for where they were. I think that was, for me, was what the first half an hour. And then all of a sudden there's a very specific scene that I'm thinking of where it changes and it says, okay, this is the direction that the film is going in now. You've got everything that you need. So you've got all the context built up now, all the exposition now. We're doing it. Let's go. And I was really pleasantly surprised by it because I think I haven't seen many of this kind of this genre of film. I'm thinking things like Fated Attraction and like Dangerous Liaisons, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah.
Films that I haven't actually seen, but you don't even need to have seen them to understand what they're like and what they're about.
Blood Simple, is of the same genre. It's only 3 years after this. I think that has a little bit, it's maybe even simpler, but maybe is slightly better executed. But I would say the neo-noirs of the late 70s and 80s, I think it's not hard to do them, to get them horribly wrong, but a lot of the ones that I've seen do follow quite a similar formula, and it just seems to work. They always have these leading men, and I think, and that's the other thing that makes this one a bit different, is there is a really meaty female role here, which why it's obviously, it was chosen as part of this theme. I think a lot of that is something that probably is missing in a lot of that. I think Blood Simple obviously had Frances McDormand, but there are so many that the women are just the mistresses and the maids, and they just are completely to the side of the action, that the men are the actual chess pieces and are actually involved. But here, and to be honest, Kathleen Turner pretty much steals it, and in her first feature film role as well.
I had only seen her as Chandler's father, mother in Friends, so a bit of a different role for her.
Yeah,
she plays both of them equally. She's a little bit more attractive in this one, I'd say. Maybe that's doing her a disservice as her male counterpart in Friends, but yeah, she's great. She really is good, and I think, again, William Hurt, it's seeing him in a slightly different way. Now, William Hurt is William Hurt at the end of the day. He does play similar roles, but it's interesting to see him as this young sort of schmoozer womanizer. Talk about there being a good female lead. He clearly is, you know, playing around, shall we say, to start with. The guy's
he's a stud. He drives like a sports car.
Anyone with that sort of moustache would be.
Moustache, he goes running along the beach, and he smokes so many cigarettes, doesn't stop smoking. Yeah, it's just oozing with 80s cool and
short shorts.
And short and very, very short sports shorts. The more you think about it, it doesn't feel profound. It doesn't feel so different that you should scream from the rooftops. But for a wild card, in comparison to School Ties, I think, by the sounds of it, we're all quite, certainly myself, quite pleasantly surprised at how much it did really get into it. And like you say, once it, after the first sort of third or so, it does really get going, and you do get into the plot, and there is some guesswork to be done.
That's where it fell down, where I felt that it was a little predictable. Now, maybe when I talk about what this theme is, you know, manipulative leading lady, then automatically you are suspicious of her, and maybe you are looking at her with a far more cynical, sinister eye than perhaps you would do if I hadn't been introduced to this film in with that context of that of that theme. And then also, you know, he's a lawyer. He's very obviously a lawyer. They make it very clear that he is a lawyer, and he's got lawyer friends and police friends, so you know there is going to be something in there that is going to involve him being a lawyer and lawyering, and you know, you know that there are the certain, you know, breadcrumbs there to that, if you're looking out for them, which maybe I was, which maybe is doing it a disservice, because it's saying that I was able to identify and able to look out for them, rather than just getting swept up in the film and going along with it. But there's some scenes, you know, you talk about it being erotic, there are some sexual scenes in here that take it a little bit further than most films do nowadays, let alone back then. So it's, I can imagine it really, it certainly was, certainly for his day, I'm sure it was. So I thought this was a another fantastic film within this theme. What a collection. Actually, I gave Love and Friendship a 2, didn't I?
Everything I hated about the film at the start, I kind of grew to accept as the film went on. The really, really, really short scenes. There were some scenes that lasted like no more than 20 seconds. But it is just trying to give you that sort of that context to where everything sits. By the end of the film became a masterstroke, if that makes sense. You know, when you think something's a negative, but it turns out to be one of the strongest points of a film. And then, yeah, no, it had me gripped till the end. It's a 4 for me.
Again, I'll probably have to give it a 4. So same score as the other two. But yeah, even with the context I found, and having seen like quite a few in this genre, I did get swept up enough. And even I was not quite as surprised, but I didn't know exactly how it was going to pan out. And it was interesting enough to be a welcome and... yeah, very solid addition to the genre. So yeah, another 4 from me.
And another 4 for me. I don't think I can really add anything that you two haven't already done so in your closing remarks. So yeah, 4s all round for this film then. A pleasant surprise. A pleasant surprise.
Long may the wild card success continue.
Yeah.
Flat 4s.
Speaking of which, nice segue on to next week.
Which is...
Oh, my turn for the new release.
Robbie's turn.
And my turn for the new release is going to be X-Men Apocalypse. So the theme is therefore superpowers. Superpowers? Superpower.
Woo.
I can tell you guys are both thrilled at the opportunity
absolutely
to watch.
Absolutely love superpowers, me.
Yeah. So in a slight twist this week, I'm on the classic. For about a week or so, my pick was The Mask with Jim Carrey, and then I did a bit more research because I thought that may not go down too well. And then when you know with X-Men Apocalypse, I thought we're struggling here. I need to get something that might bring it back up again. Pretty much every single week we're talking to some extent about neo-noir, so I thought that'll be a good film to go for.
Are you going? What I think something. You're going for, mate.
What do you think I'm going for?
No, go on.
So I'm going for The Crow.
Ooh.
Yeah.
It's very neo-noir.
Been recommended to me many a time.
Never heard of it until... I didn't think I'd heard of it anyway. When I looked it up, I realised I had done, but...
Brandon Lee's last film.
Yeah. Rest in peace.
As a result of that, because that's a good one, I guess that I'll go for something that we've seen. I'll go for Chronicle, just because it's such a... I mean, I haven't seen obviously the new release, but it's such a contrast with regard. It's coming from an independent studio and an independent. It's not a franchise, so I think definitely there'll be something to discuss between those two, and then obviously, yeah, something that's again, I think a very independent choice. So yeah, a very gritty choice. So that's all from us.